the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone, everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 244, which is 12 squared plus 10 square, I think, right? There's some square. I saw it, and I was like, oh, that's a square thing. And I was like, no, not quite.
Yeah, 12 squared, 10 squared plus 10 plus squared. 10.
That's the most important thing about the show is the numerology aspect. No, just kidding. How's it going, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk about Corey Robin, the word
that I like how, right... Like 8 or 9 people wrote to us to tell us that, you know, he was a socialist Marxist. I don't want to. I'll let him identify himself or whatever. But that he was not a conservative. Nobody wrote in to say it's pronounced Robin and not Robin.
Oh so. No, believe me, I got some heat. I got some heat in the Facebook group. It's okay, I deserved it. All right, but we're going to talk more about Corey Robin, and we're also going to talk about William Barr. And as usual, I'm sure this will go far longer than Andrew always anticipates. So I like that. I feel like you've set you've recognized that you always go long, Andrew, and you've set a more modest goal for today's show. We'll see where it ends up. It'll end up being 90 minutes, I'm sure. But for now.
Well, the Bill Barr Attorney General confirmation hearing should be underway as you download this. They are scheduled for today, Tuesday and Wednesday, and we want you to be well prepared for that. And I just had so many fun jurisprudential legal rabbit trails on the Corey Robin stuff that I figured I'd share it with everybody.
This is the number one show for jurisprudential rabbit trails. I believe that's what the reviews say. Yeah. Anyway,
fun inside fact. Jurisprudential rabbit trails was along with lawful neutral one of the rejected names for the show that we originally went with.
I thought you were gonna say it was like a band from the '60s that. Yeah. Or like a prog rock band from the '70s.
Oh,
or whatever.
Man, that would be so great. A Jefferson Airplane cover band called Jurisprudential Rabbit Trails. You could do that. I don't know who's going to sing the Grace Slick parts, but you know, we'll put out a ZipRecruiter. Anyway.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, let's get to our show.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm seeing the initials. Andrew was wrong. Well, AWW for Andrew was wrong. So more that you're wrong about?
No. But...
How wrong could one Andrew be?
Apparently pretty wrong. I felt like our listeners sort of deserved an explanation of how I came to misidentify Corey Robin a week ago, and I think there's some really fun stuff along the way. So so if you'll indulge me, I'd like to.
Sure, and I think it's also good because it does kind of point to the fact that you don't just willy nilly call people conservative that you don't like. There was a lot more behind this than just you call people conservatives who you don't like or something like that.
Yeah, I try really hard, you know, not to do that. And also this was in response to a listener question. And I want to be 100% clear, right? Like, when I get listener questions, I tend, for the main segment of the show, I tend to put in about 10 hours of researching and writing. Sometimes it's more. The PG&E segment, you know, required a ton of reading and casework and documents and stuff like that. And, you know, and that took like 20 to 25 hours just to do PG&E. When I do a listener question, I try and pick those that I can get by with a little bit less research on. And this was a question that asked for my subjective evaluation of a summary of Corey Robbins' thesis regarding Clarence Thomas. So I tried to put some error bars on it. I disclosed up front that I'd never heard of Corey Robin or read anything about him. I drew the conclusion erroneously that he was a conservative Orthodox Jew. And here's why. So the first thing I did after, you know, kind of general Googling was to go to Corey Robbins' blog and to read what he writes in his own words. And the top post right now on Corey Robbins' blog, I'll give the link in the show notes, says that I'm just going to read the paragraph, right? It says, "In shul this morning, I came upon this passage from the Talmud. Everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. It's an arresting thought on two grounds. First, we tend to think of omnipotent power as causing fear, even terror. Yet the one thing, the Talmud says, that omnipotent power cannot determine is whether we are afraid of it. Second, we tend to think of our fear as something..."
I blacked out for a minute. Is this a religion pot? What is?
Yeah. Huh? So in other words,
am I in the right? Hi, listener, am I in the right podcast? Yeah. What happened? Why, so we're doing a sermon.
His first, right? That's exactly right. That, like, look, that if you take that first post and you replace shul with Bible study and you replace Talmud with Romans 1, right? I don't think anybody would have objected to my drawing the conclusion of, okay, this seems like this is a religious conservative, particularly when I had gone through and concluded that he was conservative politically for the reasons that I'm about to get into. I felt like they were sort of mutually self-reinforcing. Apparently he's neither, but that's the source of the, I had said, I think he's motivated by Orthodox Judaism beliefs. And obviously, Orthodox Jews, like religious conservatives of other stripes, Jews in general oppose Trump. Orthodox Jews support Trump, 71% at last count. So why did I think he was conservative? There were a couple of reasons for this. The first is that there is an ongoing tone and substance to Robin's comments accusing liberals of playing identity politics. And this is a hallmark of the right now. And in fact, a hallmark of folks on the right with whom we have frequently engaged. Keep going.
Yes, and to complicate matters further, it's also a hallmark of people who are trying to claim they're liberals and actually on the left, but really they're centrist or right-wing useful morons, or not. No, that's the wrong word. There are a lot of people who do this, like, fake, "Oh no, I'm a liberal. I agree with you, but, you know, I just, here's how we fix the Democratic Party is get rid of all this Democrat stuff and do a bunch of conservative stuff."
And that is exactly the mindset I had, because the next post that we talk about is a post called "The Scandal of Democracy: Seven Theses for the Socialist Left." And I thought, I did not take it at face value. I did not take it as...
And lest anyone think I'm making this up, this was Dave Rubin's whole shtick, yeah. Was, "I'm the liberal." He literally had on... He might still have it on his Twitter thing, "The last liberal. I'm a liberal. Oh, I'm a liberal." And he's on Fox News with Tucker Carlson talking about how, you know, he's the most Fox News friendly person there could be. Like, he's so clearly conservative. And then they do the shtick. Oh, no, I'm pro gay marriage and I'm pro weed. So therefore, I mean, I'm practically Karl Marx, like with those two beliefs.
So I think
I'm not just making this up.
Corey is practically Karl Marx. But as we get there, and again, I mean that, Corey, if you're listening.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say that that's necessarily what Corey Robin is doing. I'm just saying that type of person exists out there. And so sometimes it can be tough to, you know, differentiate like the good faith from the bad faith people.
And so here was his tweet at us, right? He says, and again, he comes in hot, and that's okay, right? If somebody had called me a conservative, I probably would have come at them pretty hot too. That's fine. Then he says, one more thing, the whole exchange between these two, that's you and I, confirms the tribalism of liberals / conservatives. They so need to believe that I'm a right-wing nut to reaffirm their sense that Thomas, Clarence Thomas, is dumb, that if you end, and there's no and in here, it should be a semicolon. This is an unconnected thought. That if you're going to read a justice of color, you should read Sotomayor instead. This pretty badly misrepresents us, right? I mean, we decry tribalism on the show all the time. We said at outstanding length on the show, right, in multiple positions with multiple analogies, that Clarence Thomas is not dumb like your Uncle Frank is dumb, right? Like, we used the analogy of TV ugly. We used the analogy to George W. Bush being called stupid, right? Then that, you know, he's clearly smarter than, you know, your Uncle Frank, right? Like, I kind of don't know where to go with all that. I was most blindsided by the idea that when I said of justices that I think have an interest, because again, remember what I said was all justices have idiosyncrasies. It's not surprising that there are things about Thomas that don't peg neatly into one box. But I think that of justices with inconsistencies, I would be more interested in doing a deeper dive on, you know, someone like Sotomayor. It didn't occur to me that I was picking a justice, right, who is Latina. Like, I mean, that the racial component was just not the reason I picked Sotomayor. The reason I picked Sotomayor is because she was on my mind having dissented in Trinity Lutheran, right? Like, and I had just talked to Andrew Seidel like 5 minutes before we recorded. The jumping to, like, I never said, don't read the black guy, read the Latina. Like, that, that's a crazy position to take, and the sort of seeing liberal identity, racial politics in something that we said that I don't think can fairly be construed that way. You know, I think, like, again, that's sort of that there are a lot of comments that are like that. But let's go to what he actually wrote on jurisprudence, because this is the section that had me convinced that that he was a conservative. And let's go through it. This is his second post on his blog. So again, you know, if you want to criticize me for not reading everything he's ever, I start at the top and work my way down, right? And in his 7 theses for the socialist left, number 3 says this. Originalism held that the only justification for the court reviewing and overturning the decisions of democratically elected legislators was that it was doing so on the basis of the Constitution itself, not the living Constitution, that is, as a progressive document whose meaning changes over time, but the original Constitution. Because the original Constitution, as a written text, represents the expressed will of the people enacted in actual words that are binding across time. Counterintuitively, when it comes to the court, the idea is that it is the cold, dead hand of the past, interpreted through the abstemious and self-effacing modesty of the present, that is most likely to yield the greatest democracy in the future. And then this is what got me down a 4-hour rabbit trail. That, at any rate, was the theory, and it came to be adopted by many liberals as well. As the liberal Lawrence Tribe, paraphrasing the liberal Ronald Dworkin, paraphrasing either Nixon or Friedman or Keynes, would say in 1998, we're all originalists now, end of quote. And that blew my mind on a number of levels, because, one, Ronald Dworkin, as everybody who listens to the show knows, and Lawrence Tribe, as pretty much everyone who's listened to the show knows, are personal heroes of mine. Dworkin's books on jurisprudence are what I recommend when I am trying to defend an anti-originalist position. And he has articulated the strongest and most coherent argument against originalism that I call the ordinary model of jurisprudence, and have continued to call on the show, and I call out Ron, and the idea, and by the way, Dworkin and Tribe, although both are liberal, both have substantial differences in their jurisprudence, and have in fact engaged. They were both on the Harvard Law faculty, so it's a, you know, these guys publish articles and snipe at each other, and even though they were friends, and you know, Tribe spoke at Dworkin's funeral. So, kind of number one, amalgamating Tribe and Dworkin together as being liberals seemed like something that someone who was not a liberal would do. Number two, it was Elena Kagan in 2005, Solicitor General Elena Kagan, then Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, who said, "We're all textualists now," at a Scalia lecture. And that statement is something that conservatives say all the time. And in fact, that quote was directly leveled at me by Justin Walker during our debate. Right, you can go back and listen to it on the debate episode. So conservatives love to quote Kagan quoting that. And, you know, Kagan's statement, we don't have to get into it, but has a lot more nuance, right? But was basically like she was paying respect to Antonin Scalia's jurisprudence on the court and the effect that it had, even in how those who oppose what he has to say are responding to that jurisprudence.
So was that quote like a Overton window kind of thing? Like, he's pulled us all so far this way that we're all kind of playing his game? Is that what that meant?
Kind of. Yeah, I mean, what it said was that Scalia's contribution to jurisprudence is that even justices on the left, even justices like her, were arguing in opinions in ways that responded to Scalia's textual analysis, right? That in a William Brennan opinion in the 1970s, for example, if you had five votes, you would not have had to describe like what you think the founding fathers meant when they decided X. You would have just said, you know, what it means today and what it has meant over time. And so forcing liberals to define what the words of the text of statutes and constitutional provisions, that was one of Scalia's lasting legacies, even though, you know, obviously she strongly disagreed with Scalia on just about everything. And
so it's one of those like conservative gotcha, like using that to say, see everywhere they're actually,
yeah,
what, liberals are secret textualists, yeah, or secret originalists?
No, exactly right. To try and legitimate originalism as a constitutional philosophy, to say, see, look, even Elena Kagan says it's not just legitimate, but you're all right. And I would also add parenthetically that Elena Kagan is to the right of Tribe and Dworkin, right? Like her jurisprudential model is not as liberal as Lawrence Tribe's.
How did Nixon factor into that?
That was the hardest part to figure out. Right. because and so put a pin in that. I want to get back to Nixon because I think I ultimately figured this out. And it was, I really wanted to share it with you on the show, but it was such a total rabbit trail that I wound up, you know, kind of giving a shorthand. Next, the criticism that Ronald Dworkin is a secret originalist is a misguided criticism that conservatives have launched over the, and again, there are only a couple of law review articles, but they're law review articles with which I am familiar that badly misrepresent Ronald Dworkin's position. I should add, in terms of crediting it to Lawrence Tribe in 2008 wrote a book called The Invisible Constitution, right? The idea that Lawrence Tribe endorses textualism is, or would say we're all originalists now, is 100% the opposite of his jurisprudence. The link that Corey gives to, because he's got Say hyperlinked in the blog, goes to Antonin Scalia's book, right? A Matter of Interpretation, which was published in 1998. And in that book, Lawrence Tribe, Marianne Glendon, who is kind of an interesting non-originalist conservative, Ronald Dworkin, and somebody named Gordon Wood, with whom I am not familiar, the four of them each wrote essays in Scalia's book, with which Scalia then engaged. So, look, I don't own that book because I try not to put money in the pockets of Antonin Scalia. but there's a Fordham Law Review article that responds to those essays and gives. And so it is clear to me that this is not a fair representation of Tribe or Dworkin's position. And in fact, right, here's what Dworkin says, right? This is from that Fordham Law Review article. Dworkin says, constitutional lawyers like to think that fidelity to the Constitution means fidelity to its text. It is the kind of fidelity demanded by self-styled constitutional, quote, originalists like Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and rejected by critics of originalism like Professor Lawrence Tribe. Then he says, I shall argue that even if we concentrate exclusively on textual fidelity, we reach radically different conclusions from those that Scalia and other originalists expect, right? So that's where that little bit of kind of saying, even if we use your methodology, we don't get your results, was what led a couple of lawyers to say, Dworkin has embraced originalism. Dworkin wrote back to that. And in fact, in the same footnote, he says, because Lawrence Tribe asked him, right, and said, well, it sounds like you are reaching kind of a similar result. And in the footnote to Tribe, Dworkin says, Tribe must have been misled by my argumentative strategy, he means, in engaging with Antonin Scalia. I did not mean in my brief remarks, again, in A Matter of Interpretation, to abandon either my longstanding opposition to any form of originalism on the count of statutory and constitutional interpretation. My argument on this occasion was ad hominem. I was responding to Scalia's lectures by pointing out the deep inconsistency that I just described. I argued that if one is a semantic originalist, as Scalia says he is, then one must endorse a reading of the Constitution from which he and any other self-described constitutional originalist would recoil. So I read that. I was super puzzled. And like you, I was like, where in the hell is this Nixon thing coming from? And I think I figured it out. And again, I think I figured it out at the time. There is a 2001 Law Review article written by Keith Whittington. It is called Dworkin's Originalism, The Role of Intentions in Constitutional Interpretation. And it is one of those handful of articles that I described that tries to make the argument that I had previously described. It contains the Nixon reference, right? And the first footnote thanks Robert George, Corey Robin, Joe Mink, and the anonymous referees for, quote, their helpful comments, end of quote. Now, let me expound. Keith Whittington is a member of the Federalist Society. He is a very conservative legal theorist. Robert George is a very conservative legal theorist. He has a view of natural law as having normative implications, which means that the Supreme Court's decisions on gay marriage, for example, are, in his view, invalid. I don't have the time to go into Robert George's natural law theory, but it is an incredible minority view, and it is being offered in defense of socially conservative, religiously motivated positions, usually relating to gay rights. I don't know who Joe Mink is. Obviously, I don't know who the anonymous referees are. But so I kind of put all that together and I said, okay. And again, look, like as clearly happened here, right, it wouldn't be surprising if somebody very conservative sent me their law review manuscript and said, hey, pick as many holes in this as you can. Do whatever you want to this, and I would love your comments. That does happen. But I looked at it and I said, oh, okay. Right. Federalist Society guy writing this. I know Robert George is conservative, and it just sort of reinforced in my mind. Okay, well then I guess that's where this, you know, where Corey Rabin comes out as well, because he plainly seems to be echoing the same conclusions. And what I would say are strongly claim are mistaken conclusions that Whittington makes in his law review article, down to the Nixon reference, which I can't find anywhere else. Right. And I don't even, it doesn't even say what the paraphrase is supposed to be. It's just there's a discussion of Dworkin's views under Nixon. Right. So I put that all together. I got it wrong. Right. I got it very wrong. But that was the thought process. And I want to give you credit, right? Because Thomas, you mentioned that he writes for Jacobin magazine, and it gave you some pause, and it should have given me more pause. It should have. And I made a glib remark about, you know, and I shouldn't have dismissed it that easily. I had formed a conclusion based on what I thought was a misrepresentation of Lawrence Tribe and Ronald Dworkin, and that's why I got it wrong. And what I really regret is that has led a couple of people to then, you know, sort of dismiss what we said on the merits, which I stand by, right? And I want to go into that a little bit. The central claim to which I wanted to respond was Robin's argument that it's racist to call out Clarence Thomas's intellect because the only other justice that is criticized in that way was Thurgood Marshall. And I took, as soon as I read that, it's why I took the question on the air. It's why I devote a lot of time to it. Not because I wanted to get into the weeds of who Corey Rabin is, but because accusations that African Americans are lazy is obviously, you know, are obviously at the core of a great number of, you know, racist insults and tropes. And if I was engaging in subconscious racism, I take that very seriously. I think we showed, and I think it continues to be true, that no part of that argument works. But Corey wrote back to us with a 13-line blurb from his book that contains sort of four claims in it. And I want to respond to those. But first, I mean, I just want to make sure that we're parsing out all of the components of this argument, because I do not think this argument works. For this argument to work, dumber white Supreme Court justices must face less criticism than Thomas and Marshall on the basis of their intellect. But that's not true, right? And as we pointed out in the previous episode, in 242, there have been a number of white Supreme Court justices who have been decried as dumb or lazy. So from there, that should really be sufficient, right? Like the fact that this is leveled at other white justices means it's not just suspicious to say, okay, a justice is intellectually incurious or is lazy. It must also have been a prevailing view of Thurgood Marshall as it is of Clarence Thomas. And I want to unpack this because I didn't do a great job of this on 242. Thurgood Marshall was the first African-American Supreme Court justice, right? It would be stupid and ahistorical for me to claim that he didn't face racism, right? Like, of course, there were racists that said stupid things about Thurgood Marshall, right? So if the bar is, or if I had suggested that nobody ever criticized Thurgood Marshall for stupid reasons masquerading as race, I certainly would not have meant to have said that, because he was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1967, right? Like, it was still okay to be openly racist in many quarters in 1967. But Clarence Thomas, right? The conventional wisdom, right? If you ask the average person who can name a Supreme Court justice and they name Clarence Thomas, what do you think of Clarence Thomas? They would say, oh yeah, like he's, doesn't seem to be that bright. He's, kind of lazy. He never asks questions, right? Like that is conventional wisdom around Clarence Thomas. And it absolutely.
Well, and it's based on the fact that he literally doesn't talk during.
Right. Yeah. He went over 10 years between asking a question and oral arguments. Right?
That we didn't make that up. Right. Like that wasn't.
Yeah. No, that is, like, that is a fact.
He literally did not talk for 10 years.
Yeah.
And on, I mean, Come on.
And so...
And wasn't... Am I remembering this wrong? Wasn't he like the only... Didn't you say... I could be wrong, but didn't you say he was the only Supreme Court justice to get like a not passing rating from the Bar Association or something like that? What was that? Was that him?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The American Bar Association during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings rated him qualified, but not well qualified. And there were serious questions about his intellectual fitness at the time that he was nominated. And I tried to share those. So the only way in which reporting those criticisms is racist is, right, by implication, if those claims were also raised about Thurgood Marshall, about whom it's preposterous to say, you know, he is not intellectually qualified to be on the Supreme Court. And again, I can tell you, and I want to go through a couple of the specific examples because I think a few are misrepresentations. I think there's actually one, and Corey, if you're still listening, I think there's one you haven't found for your book. So, you know, there are a handful of statements that are out there that are troubling and racist, but in no way was Thurgood Marshall systematically unfairly labeled not smart or lazy. So let's go through that, right? And again, remember, there's also a bit of a visceral reaction here because I grew up with Thurgood Marshall on the court, and Thurgood Marshall practiced law. I mean, built his law practice in Baltimore, right? So, you know, so he's revered here, but I'm pretty sure he's revered everywhere. Let's be 100% clear, right? Thurgood Marshall was the lawyer who argued Brown versus Board of Education before the Supreme Court. That is literally the most landmark case of all time, right? But if you're a lawyer, you would know he also argued Shelley versus Kramer in 1948. It's equally a landmark, right? That Shelley versus Kramer struck down racially restrictive covenants. And Thurgood Marshall won that case in front of the Supreme Court unanimously in 1948. And
wow.
Put an asterisk on unanimously, that decision was 6-0. You want to know why three justices recused themselves from Shelley versus Kramer?
Because they're racist?
Because they owned property with racially restrictive covenants in them. Yes. Right?
So yes.
Yes. Right. And let's, I think all our listeners know this, but a racially restrictive covenant is Thomas sells his house to Andrew subject to the covenant that I never sell it to a black person. Right. And Thurgood Marshall.
So yes, racist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thurgood Marshall got that invalidated as unconstitutional in 1948 in a case that,
wow,
that all lawyers recognize
so
as.
Thurgood Marshall was qualified.
Yeah.
Well qualified.
He was the architect of the strategy that transformed civil rights in this country. He was then appointed by JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, to the Second Circuit. He was made Solicitor General under Lyndon Johnson, and then elevated to the Supreme Court. He was, at the time of his elevation to the Supreme Court, he was criticized for being liberal. He was not criticized for being not qualified.
Right.
He was confirmed 69-11. The 11 votes all came from Robert Byrd, Strom Thurmond, Deep South racists. He was opposed as a judicial activist, but here was the opposition from conservative commentator James J. Kilpatrick. Marshall was, quote, more qualified for the Supreme Court than many of his predecessors. And then Kilpatrick goes on to praise his, quote, skill and industry, end of quote, but says that we should oppose having Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court because it would, quote, upset the rough balance of liberalism and conservatism that recently has prevailed upon the high tribunal and place the judicial activists in full control. So, and you will recognize, right? Like, that's the same argument that has been leveled at every Democratic appointee since, right? You know, the more things change.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to link in the show notes a Juan Williams article from the Washington Post 1990, summarizing Thurgood Marshall's career. He was still on the court. He would remain on the court until 1991, but he was 81 in 1990. And And it, I think, summarizes the wide, broad-based regard with which Thurgood Marshall was held. And I just do not believe that anybody can muster the evidence to show that it was the prevailing view that Thurgood Marshall was intellectually lazy or not qualified for the Supreme Court. Now, that begs the question, was it the view of anybody? And here, Robin gives us four examples. And I want to tackle all four of these. I'll link his tweet out to us. The first is, and I'm doing these in analytical.
So wait, I just want to make sure I have this right. He doubled down on the Thurgood Marshall point? Because I thought you did a good job of pointing out that, like, the only time that people criticized him as, you know, possibly intellectually, you know, deficient was when his, you know, he was 1,000 years old and he was maybe.
Yeah. And Corey Robbins says that's not true. Corey Robbins says there are wide-ranging criticisms, racist criticisms of his intellectual capacity and laziness. So here are those four claims, and I'm going to tackle these in an analytical order. They're not the order that Corey presents them to us, but here they go. First, law clerks on the court called him Justice Brennan / Marshall behind his back. Now that, I got to unpack this a little bit because it's not really the same claim. It is related to another claim that people have made about Clarence Thomas, which is that Clarence Thomas was Antonin Scalia's second vote. And by the way, that would be a fair thing for Corey to criticize when people said, I guess, because Antonin Scalia is dead. But if you say that Clarence Thomas was, just Antonin Scalia's second vote, that would not be true, right? As of 2014, Scalia was the justice with whom Clarence Thomas most voted 91% of the time. But he also voted 91% of the time with Sam Alito, 90% of the time with Roberts. And, you know, what that shows is that Clarence Thomas is a conservative and he voted with the other conservative justices. That's not surprising. And Kagan and Ginsburg, for example, voted together 93% of the time. And nobody says that Elena Kagan is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's second vote, right? Roberts and Alito voted together 93% of the time, and nobody said Alito is Roberts' second vote or vice versa. So I agree that that claim, which we didn't talk about, would be a little bit unfair to level at Clarence Thomas. But what about as leveled against Thurgood Marshall, right? So this is what he's trying to say, is that the law clerks accused him of just being a puppet for Justice Brennan. William Brennan is the most influential liberal Supreme Court justice, at least of the past 50 years, probably of all time. I've talked about him on the show at great length. I think that this claim about law clerks saying this dates from the Bob Woodward and Armstrong book, The Brethren, which was initially published in 1979, has been updated multiple times since then. But this comes from the original edition of The Brethren. Here's what they say in full context. Marshall pioneered the civil rights battle against segregation in housing, public accommodations, and schools. He won 29 of the 32 cases he argued before the Supreme Court. Facts, and again, not something that seems to undercut his intellect. Then they tell this incident, and here's how Woodward and Armstrong put it. Marshall was relaxed, almost intuitively reaching the common sense solution. He had fit easily into the Warren Court's liberal majority. Plain spoken and direct, Marshall saw his job as casting his vote and urging his colleagues to do what is right. On the court, he had little interest in perfecting the finger. He means finer, but it's uncorrected. In perfecting the finger points of law, he told his clerks. Right, it's supposed to be finer, but I'm proving that I've read this right. He often told his clerks, only half jokingly, "I'll do whatever Bill Brennan does." Sometimes, even jotting quote "follow Bill" on his notes. He trusted Brennan's resolution of the detailed technical question of legal scholarship. The clerks had taken to calling Marshall quote, Mr. Justice Brennan-Marshall, end quote. And then, this is going back to Bob Woodward's words here, often he would follow Wizard White on antitrust cases, but on discrimination cases, Marshall followed no one. That, to me, does not support the contention that clerks were calling Justice Thurgood Marshall Justice Brennan Marshall behind his back, which is how Corey Robin has written it. It seems to be to his face, up in front, with full view of Thurgood Marshall saying, I am not the interested in jurisprudence and minutia to the same degree as William Brennan. I defer to somebody who is a towering intellect and cares about the minutia of these things. And by the way, that's a perfect, and it is totally consistent with everything I've read about Thurgood Marshall. He had a very self-effacing kind of personality. He would, you know, tease that it's just like it's totally consistent to imagine him to his clerks saying, oh yeah, I'm just going to do, you know, whatever Bill Brennan does. And by the way, that same dynamic seems to be the case about Clarence Thomas, right? There is there's a lawyer, I'll link it in the show notes, a lawyer named Mark Howell who attended a talk by Clarence Thomas. And when the questioner asked him how he went about deciding cases, Clarence Thomas quipped, well, I just go down the hall and ask Scalia what the right answer is, end of quote. So the way I put that together, right, is I see Thurgood Marshall as a pragmatist, which he very clearly was. He was alongside the most influential liberal jurist of the past 100 years in William Brennan. Brennan was the left's Scalia, right? He was a towering force on the court. So this first piece, the way I assess all of it, I cannot see how you can read that passage in The Brethren and interpret that as Thurgood Marshall's clerks were laughing at him behind his back for not being smart enough.
Can I just take a second to try to, I don't know, untangle this Ouroboros of an argument that what is happening here? So the guy whose name I mispronounced, who I'm not familiar with, is saying, who's the you guys are just tribalists, you know, Thomas and Andrew, you're just tribalists, and furthermore, the left is caught up in identity politics. And also, here's why what you're saying about Clarence Thomas is racist because of what other people might have said about Thurgood Marshall. What is this argument? I don't even understand. It has nothing to do with the substance of anything.
So the argument, to steel man the argument is that accusing a Supreme Court justice of being not intellectually rigorous or being lazy is racist because that kind of argument is only ever deployed against African Americans.
Well, it sounds like all we need to do is just say, okay, well, then he's engaging in identity politics, which by his definition is not
I suppose,
valid.
I suppose so. We could do that. But look, like I wanted to fully unpack that claim. And again, I felt like we said it enough, but it's worth saying it again. Like, neither you nor I are saying that Clarence Thomas, you know, is stupid, right? Like, that's not, despite the fact that Corey Robin attributes that to us, we haven't said it. I wouldn't say it.
And furthermore, I'm the one who's always arguing that Scalia was stupid.
Right,
he's actually a genius, just a misguided genius. And I'm like, no, I think he's stupid. I'm not a fan. So, like, it has nothing to do with race. So you're Mr. Anti-Identity Politics. We can move on from his identity politics that he's doing right now to try to disprove an argument that has nothing to do with his argument has nothing to do with the substance of what you're saying. It's merely I don't know if he's just messing with you or what, like trying to get you to spin your wheels on this or because this has nothing to do with anything.
So. I want to see if it is the case that this is the kind of accusation that was leveled at Thurgood Marshall, and it seems to me that it just isn't. So that was kind of point one. Law clerks were not muttering behind Thurgood Marshall's back. Number two, He also cites directly to the brethren, to Woodward and Armstrong, and which is why I think it's the source of the first one as well, where they ostensibly criticize him, Thurgood Marshall, for watching TV during the day. This is not in the original 1979 version, so I can only assume that this is from an updated version and is the exact same incident and behavior that we talked about in the Jacoby article on the last show, right? Which is an indictment of Thurgood Marshall when he was 80 years old and not directed to race or his career, but addressed to his current mental capacities. Number three, he says, Marshall's dozing visage donned a 1989 cover of the National Review with the caption, "While Justice Sleeps," and the article wondered, of the 15 or so opinions the court assigned to Marshall during this term, how many does he and not his clerks actually write? I want to unpack this one because, number one, it's from the April 21st, 1989 version of the National Review, not available online. I cannot find anywhere. I have to go to a library to pull that up.
My dad probably has a copy.
Yeah, somewhere. The National Review is a conservative rag. It was published just after George H.W. Bush won election. And so what you have are conservatives gleefully arguing in print that Thurgood Marshall should step down from the court so that Bush can nominate a conservative to the court, who would turn out to be Clarence Thomas. Marshall was 80 at the time. And so, again, I think that's the context in which to understand that. But if you want to say to me that people associated with the George H.W. Bush campaign were racists, I would say you don't have a whole lot to do to persuade me of that, right? Like, that's Lee Atwater's calling card, right? But it dovetails in with the last point that he makes that I wanted to find out about, which was Archibald Cox, who was later the special prosecutor that Nixon fired, right? Said that of Thurgood Marshall, quote, "He may not be very bright, but he picks the best law clerks in town," end of quote. And that goes back to the notion that Marshall isn't writing his opinions. His clerks are writing his opinions. And that's also kind of a dig at his intellect. And for here, I'm going to try. I wasn't able to find a public version of this, so if I can, I will upload a link. Otherwise, it's copyrighted. It's a Mark Tushnet Law Review article in Georgetown, in the Georgetown Law Review symposium speech that he gave in 1992, the year before Thurgood Marshall died, the year after Thurgood Marshall had resigned from the Supreme Court. Mark Tushnet is a former Thurgood Marshall clerk, and in this article, he talks about the criticism that Thurgood Marshall relied on his law clerks to write his opinions. And what Tushnet says was, Marshall relied more heavily on his law clerks for opinion writing than did the other justices during the early years of his tenure. But his practices were not wildly out of line with those of others on the court. Yet ideological critics such as Terry Eastland, who served as a speechwriter in the Department of Justice during the Reagan administration, criticized Marshall and some of his colleagues for their heavy use of law clerks, saying, quote, "Relying on clerks is a cheat on democratic government," end of quote. And again, I wanted to kind of get in there a little bit. Notice Tushnet is saying that Eastland, working in the Reagan administration, was criticizing Marshall and some of his colleagues, right, who, by the way, definitionally were clearly not black, for their heavy use of clerks. So again, I think all of this goes back to that the principal criticism around Thurgood Marshall was ideologically and not racially motivated. And that to the extent that there seems to be an overlap, I don't see anybody arguing that Clarence Thomas makes excessive use of his law clerks. I'm sure Corey Robin will have some examples of that. It wouldn't surprise me if someone has. Because as a former clerk, right, you see lots of different practices, and it wouldn't be weird to me, right? Like, I don't know, for example, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Antonin Scalia, right, to name two people who are, or in Scalia's case, were people I would consider to be towering intellects. I don't know whether they had clerks write the first draft of their opinions or not. Right. It that doesn't in any way bear on their intellect. So I don't fully understand that criticism, but I wanted to fully unpack
it. I just want to note one last time for the record that Mr. Anti-Identity Politics is responding to your claims about Clarence Thomas and his competence by and it's turning on whether or not some people from Nixon's time might have been racist when they criticized Thurgood Marshall. I just want to point that out. I don't know that
point
I could say anything more about it.
And now I want to give one. So I think because I would be surprised if Corey hasn't read this Tushnet article. It's a 1992 Georgetown Law Review. But Tushnet relays the following statement in the middle. It's the only one, but he relays this from Judge Henry Friendly, who was on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and served alongside Thurgood Marshall when Thurgood Marshall was on that court. Wrote a letter to Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter and expressed what Tushnet calls, quote, a criticism typical of those who disagreed with Marshall's answers to legal questions, end quote. And here's what Friendly said. I do not have the feeling that he, Thurgood Marshall, realizes the difficulties of his job and is burning the midnight oil in an effort to conquer them. Rather, he seems convinced that the problems are pretty easy and that he is fairly well equipped to grapple with them, or rather to follow someone else's grapple. All of this makes life fairly easy for him, save when he is confronted with a difference of opinion and then he tosses a coin. That's racist and awful and stupid. And so if you want to muster some evidence in support of this thesis, I would take that letter. But I do not think so. I offer that one to you.
Okay. Well, if Second Circuit Judge Henry Friendly were on the show and saying that Clarence Thomas was unintelligent, then maybe you'd have a point. And you could point to that and say, hey, look, in the past, Second Court Circuit Justice Henry Friendly, you were kind of pretty racist about this, so maybe you're also being racist when it has nothing to do with anything. All right, sorry. This is just frustrating.
So there we go. Well, now we're done, and we don't ever have to revisit this. But
okay.
But I did want to.
You know what? I'm going back to pronouncing it Robin just because of all this.
That's great.
That's what I have to
we're
say.
We're never going to be left out. Look, like let's come back together, right? I can imagine that. Robin and the two of us, we probably agree on an awful lot, but I continue to think I support the project to find something interesting to say about Clarence Thomas. You know, my old torts professor, Mort the Tort Horowitz, had the distinction of being at the time what he described as the only published law professor to have written an article on the Third Amendment. You know, go for it, right? But I just can't buy into that component of the criticism. I don't see a link that criticisms of Thomas's intellectual curiosity are by definition racist. I just don't see it.
Hey, folks. Well, it is the new year. I'm sure we've already got several resolutions that we are violating, not keeping up with. But here's how Harry's Razors can help you. Maybe your resolution was to be smarter with your personal finances. Well, Harry's can save you about $100 a year if you're a regular shaver. Maybe your resolution was to take better physical care of yourself. Harry's products have won tons of awards, including a 2018 Esquire Grooming Award. They'll keep you looking and feeling great. I personally love Harry's because it used to be impossible back in the day to get both a good, smooth, comfortable shave and not spend $1 million on replacement blades. And this is exactly the problem that Harry's was founded in order to solve. They were tired of paying for razors that were overpriced and overdesigned. Harry's fixed all that by combining a simple, clean design with quality, durable blades at a fair price. In fact, Harry's replacement cartridges are just $2 each, and they have a 100% quality guarantee. Harry's wants you to start the new year off right, so they created a trial offer. Claim yours by going to harrys.com/arguments. Get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. And once again, listeners of our show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/arguments. Make sure you go to harrys.com/arguments to redeem your offer and let them know we sent you to help support the show. Let's
get political. Political. I wanna get political. Let's get into political.
So we got like a minute to talk about Bill Barr.
Yeah. So here's what I want you to be on the lookout for about Bill Barr. Our friends over at the FFRF, including Andrew Seidel, have pointed out that Barr has expressed really extreme positions when it comes to decrying the, quote, secular influence in the United States. He, in particular, Barr wrote an article for The Catholic Lawyer in 1995, in which he argues that the demise of the, quote, Judeo-Christian system would have grave consequences for the future of self-government in the United States. And then he quotes from James Madison. And here's the quote he attributes to James Madison. In the words of James Madison, "We have staked our future on the ability of each of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God," end of quote. And then Andrew notes,
which, by the way, 5 or 6 of those are related to not worshiping other idols before God, which is not something we at all care about in government.
It's far worse than that, though, because as Andrew Seidel points out, although Barr's 12-page article contains nearly 50 footnotes, citations, he does not cite this quotation from Madison. And the reason is because it does not exist. James Madison never said it. It was made up by David Barton, serial plagiarist and prevaricator David Barton, and puppet of the extreme religious right who just pumps out high-grade nonsense. I mean, you know, Barton's book had to be pulled from the shelves by the publisher because, quote, the basic truths were not there, end of quote. If something is sourced to David Barton, you can almost be certain that it is made up. For an attorney general to be reading and familiar and quoting and running in the circles with David Barton is troubling. So that's what I want you guys to be on the lookout for in the Tuesday and Wednesday hearings, whether these questions are asked, whether someone asks Bill Barr what his views are on separation of church and state, how he intends to utilize the attorney general's office, whether he endorses. He wrote an op-ed endorsing Jeff Sessions. And so, you know, whether he intends to continue the shift under Sessions towards protecting, quote, religious freedom, end quote, of the overwhelming majority religion in this country. Be interesting to watch.
Oh, man. I love how people think the Ten Commandments has anything to do with government or how we would want the country to run. They're terrible. The Ten Commandments are terrible. Does everybody know this? Google them. They're not good. By the way, thou shalt not have slaves is not a commandment. Just, that's not one of them. That didn't make it.
You have to do top 10, right? I mean, you
know. Yeah. And five or six of them are like, I'm very jealous, God. If you worship something other than me, I take it very personally. So please don't do that, guys. That's like the first 5 of them. So just so you know. Okay. That's the idea that if they have anything to do with law or government is absurd, or that they should rather with any good, you know, civil government. Okay. Is that all we have time
for?
That
is all we have time for.
Okay. Well, it is time for our co-favorite segment of the week, and that is thanking our new patrons over on patreon.com/law.
And thank you to Mirveka S. Venice, to Andrew Gerard Martin, Jonathan, to That's Our Show for Today, and it is, to Dan Martin, and to Writ of Matt Damon's.
All right, and a begrudging thanks, because this is actually, this is real, this person drives me nuts, but they pledge, so I guess, you know, the rules are the rules. MAGA hatter hate funding libs at Real Faceless Man. I think that's somebody I ended up blocking or muting on Twitter because they're that annoying.
Hey, but if you want to hate fund us, like go right ahead. Yeah, that's fine. We'll read it on the air.
Yep. Sam Wakelum, immune foreign sovereign, David Bax, and Satanic Nightjar. Weird. Okay. Thanks, new patrons. We really appreciate it. Hope you enjoy the goodies.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time to find out if my improbable streak continues and I go two in a row, or if, as usual, I crashed and burned on a real property question.
Yeah, your improbable streak of one is on the line. Here we go. So real property question. Seller and purchaser signed a contract for the sale of a 60-year-old house. The purchaser did not bother to ask whether the what the condition of the house was. The contract required a warranty deed to be given at closing. And so put a pin in that because that's the test of this question, right? Mm. So then the purchaser receives the warranty deed with all covenants of title at the closing, records the deal, and then 1 month afterwards, the entirety of Eli's house just combusts, you know, the basement floods, it becomes uninhabitable, it's terrible, and then delightfully in the question, it says, the seller was genuinely surprised. And so obviously, purchaser sues the seller. Is he likely to be successful? You instantly eliminated both yes answers and said, it seems like you can sell fixer-uppers, so got to be a yes answer. So you eliminated the first yes answer, yes, because with a conveyance of residential real property, a warranty of fitness is implied. And that's a great elimination. I am really hoping we get some A answers from lawyers and law students over the weekend, because when you have a newly constructed residential property, that does convey a warranty of fitness, right? So the builder or the developer sells you a brand new house that has a warranty of fitness for that particular purpose.
You know, I don't want to take credit. I think I kind of lucked into that. I didn't know that.
I
missed the residential part of the real property because I think I said, can't you sell someone a swamp? Oftentimes I really am trying to answer these with no background, no time, whatever. And sometimes I'm overwhelmed especially with real property. And gosh, it's so easy to miss a word here or there that ends up being important. But it sounds like I lucked into that elimination. Yep.
So then we're gonna skip B for a minute.
Great. That's always a good sign.
you picked of the no answers, you picked no because the seller gave no warranty regarding the condition of the house. That was C. Eliminating D, no, because of the doctrine of merger. And I want to tell you, D, also a really, really good elimination. The doctrine of merger has nothing to do with this question. It's an unattractive distractor. So now the question comes down to, what the hell is a warranty deed, right? Because if a warranty deed has something to do with the condition of the house, then B would be the right answer, right? Because the covenants of title conveyed in that warranty deed.
That's reasonable.
Right?
I almost did that, but anyway.
It was good. I like it.
No, I mean, I was guessing C for sure, but I almost was going to do my second chance of B and C, but I didn't get there. So that's okay.
I like you pushing all in at the table. And if the warranty deed has nothing to do with the fitness of the property, then C is the correct answer. And I am pleased to tell you that in fact C is the correct answer.
All right.
Yeah. The warranty deed was meant to be the attractive distractor here. A warranty deed says that you, as the seller, warrant that you have clear title to sell the property, right? That nobody else owns any interest in it. And remember,
but they wanted people like me to think, oh, warranty. That's like when you have a guarantee on, you buy a fridge and it comes with a warranty. Yep. I think
that is exactly what they wanted you to think, and you did not fall for it. So great job!
I'm too dumb to fall for that one. I would have needed to be smarter. I think
they said I was dumb, but I showed them.
Yeah. No, that's good. My strategy of trying to pick the obvious one, because this felt like the, you know, the clear cut, easy answer, which is not always right. But my strategy with real property, because it's impossible, is I'm going to try to pick the clear one and hope that it's right a little bit better than chance. I don't know. I'm not sure if it will be, but that's my plan. That's my test taking strategy.
I like it. Well, congratulations. Served you well on this one.
All right. Yeah. And, you know, my intuition really just was that, you know, 60-year-old house, like, yeah. I mean, houses fall apart after you buy them all the time. And I feel like there's not. But, you know, it could have been true that a warranty deed had something to do with, you know, some special guarantee that it was OK. But all right. Lucked into that a little bit. But, you know, I think luck slash recognizing my probabilities and going, I'm making a decision. I was ready to be wrong and still believe in my system. But okay, that's where we are. All right. Let's find out who our lucky winner is this week. Future Andrew, give it to us.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, there were lots of good answers this week. I want to give an implied shout out to Tom Wagoner. Go look it up. He gave, I think, the funniest answer. But this week's winner is actually The Brevity, who, living up to his or her name, says, the answer is C. I'm with Thomas. Implied warranties are for renters. Buyers beware. So everyone give at the underscore brevity, B-R-E-V-I-T-Y, a follow on Twitter. Somebody who who lives up to their Twitter handle. Nice work. Brief, to the point, correct. Congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And that was a bit of a deep dive, weird one, but I had a lot of interesting history in it. And I think learning more about Thurgood Marshall and a lot of the other figures you talked about was fascinating. So thanks for that. And we'll see you for Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.